Exactly.
You know,
well, and that's why you have to build those supports and other.
Ready?
Oh, scratch ready.
I've heard of Black Irish before, but wow.
March 17th, St. Patrick's Day. It's 8:30 in the morning or thereabouts. This is a public hearing on Senate Bill 5526. The Oregon Health Authority will be finishing up MAP this morning and getting started in addictions and mental health. Linda, any comments?
That's it.
I expect you all to present today in Gaelic. which for some of us would be just about as meaningful as being in English. So please begin, introduce yourselves to the committee, and get started. Yes,
Mr. Chair.
Representative Olson. I don't think I want to hear
See,
this.
We didn't.
I have a hunch. I don't really want to hear this, but go ahead.
What do you mean by that?
Well, I'm going to wait if you say.
I was wondering if we could all join in a nice little chorus of happy birthday to Dr. Bates. Okay, one, two, three.
Happy birthday to you. Happy birthday to you. Happy birthday, dear Dr. Bates. Happy birthday to you.
My only comment will be that my mother's Irish, side of the family is completely Irish occurrence, and my dad's about 3/4 Irish. So when I was born, our entire family went on a drunk that I don't think we ever recovered from. I hope you all go out to an Irish bar tonight and have a good time. Buckley and I are going to go out and have dinner and probably do the same thing. But we're going to be very calm and careful because at my age, you know, one dram gets you in trouble. You know?
Or gram.
Oh, yeah.
As long as it's
so
very
let's get there. Started.
Okay. Well, good morning. For the record, my name is Judy Moore Peterson. I'm the state's Medicaid director with the Oregon Health Authority. With me is...
thank you. Chairs and members of the committee, Kate Nass with the Department of Administrative Services, Chief Financial Office today.
And we left off yesterday on slide 24. We were talking about the major budget drivers, or we just turned to this slide and we haven't begun any sort of conversation about it. And I have several points on this particular slide, and these are as much major budget drivers as they are also budget risks, because there tends to be a lot of volatility with each of these elements. In particular, there tends to be a lot of volatility with the caseload forecast. As you may recall, when I presented the slide on how many people there were and then what the costs were, that, if, for example, it does not take very many people to be off when you're talking about the age of the blind and age of the disabled populations, you can be, 100 more than what had been forecast or 100 less, and you can be talking about millions of dollars. Whereas if you talk about children and the variation in children, it takes a lot more children variation in the child forecast to have the same sort of a budgetary impact. So the upcoming caseload forecast, the other thing that also impacts our overall caseload is the fact that with our major expansion and bringing in so many additional adults, we still have not yet figured out or worked through all the new patterns of renewals, redeterminations, of how many additional people will be coming on, et cetera. And so there's still quite a bit of expected volatility in the estimates, et cetera, as we work through what those changes, what we anticipate those changes to be. Another impact on the budget that also tends to fluctuate quite considerably is also the tobacco tax forecast. We do rely on the tobacco tax within the medical assistance program's budget, and there do tend to be variations of as much as $10 million per sometimes per quarter. So then we need to make up for that, or you know, I get additional dollars that then are attributed to our budget. A couple of other cost drivers that we're expecting and that we are considering as we move forward into this next biennium are expensive treatment advances. An example of that are there's a new group of hepatitis C pharmaceuticals that are online that tend to be highly very expensive treatments. And it's not unusual to have new expensive treatments. I think the degree or the cost of these particular very effective treatments, but the cost is quite high. And so there's quite a bit of national conversation about what's the best way to move forward with these, but it does have a budgetary impact on medical assistance programs.
Senator Steiner-Hayward has a question.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Ms. Moore-Peterson, one of the things that's been in the news a lot lately, and I'm seeing this all over the place, is a significant increase in price in generic drugs, even drugs that have been on the market 15, 20, 25 years as generics are suddenly doubling and tripling in price. I know that the state obviously has options because we buy medications in bulk to a large extent and negotiate, but how much is that driving the budget at all, if at all, or have we seen changes because of the prescription drug prices, even generics?
Co-chairs, Senator Steiner-Hayward. We have seen some increases in generics. I would have to get specific information about the degree to which that's impacting us. It is not one of the major budget factors at this point. It still remains the more specialty drugs have the larger budgetary impact, but we can get additional information for you.
I'd appreciate it because I do think that, I mean, you know, when you're seeing common drugs suddenly go from being $40 a month to being $120 a month, when you have as many people, you have a million people on OHP, then all of a sudden that turns into real money.
Right.
I'd be interested to see how that's playing out for you all. Thank you.
Great, thank you.
Judy, while we're on this topic, I was going to ask a question too. Hepatitis C drugs. Right now we have a limitation on them based on the degree of your cirrhosis or your liver damage. That could easily be challenged in court and changed. These hepatitis C drugs work at any level. And they're extremely expensive, $60,000 to $90,000 for a treatment, mm-hmm. all taking place in 1 month. We're building rates right now, looking carefully at rates in OHA for the MAP program. Mm-hmm. It's very controversial, and we have several things that I'm concerned about, well, not only this, but some cost in mental health, especially in the new kinds of centers being set up. I think we're going to hear about that later today and tomorrow. Which are have great potential for this state. We have a lot of things that are just sort of breaking right now that need to be built into the rates to submit to CMS. That's going to be really tricky to do. We're not sure of our population. We've got hepatitis C out there. We've got mental health issues out there we need to build back in. How's that discussion going right now?
Co-chairs, well, members of the committee.
Not ask the question.
So, I think that you hit the nail on the head in the sense that there are lots of complicating factors. There's a lot of aspects about the rates development that is complicated, and that we are wrestling with those topics. You know, currently, as we speak, we're working on those. I think that we've laid the foundation to do the best job that we can in re-examining the rates and taking a look at what the possibilities are of working through those complicated topics. topics. We had already started to work on the to see what kind of adjustments may be needed for new therapies like the hepatitis C. Of course, we are always balancing that with also maintaining or not going above that trend line, and so that's the that is what we're trying to balance as we work our way through those issues. I think that the mental health is another complicated area, and to the degree that you can find cost savings in some areas and versus, you know, higher prices in other. You know, one of the things that we're taking into consideration when we're looking at the new expensive treatments like hepatitis C drugs is that the treating of hepatitis C is expensive today. You know, particularly for those people with who already have the advanced stages of that and are suffering from cirrhosis of the liver and may need a transplant or are currently on treatments. Those are expensive treatments as well. And so it is a matter of not just looking at the cost of the treatment, but also putting it into the larger context of what does it cost to treat hepatitis C, and then what's the net difference? And then, and it's not just about cost, of course, it's also about that this is can be a really highly effective cure for hepatitis C, and looking for the best treatment options in that consideration.
I would like to have you continue to keep this committee up to date on rate setting, who your team is. You know, I know you brought Optimus in, and your own team, who you're working with in the CCOs, the individuals you've selected to help work with those typical things, and information you're receiving back from CMS. I know they've sent a series of questions back to you.
Mm-hmm.
I'd like to see those questions and talk those through with you. Really be transparent and let everybody come together and try to make this something that is as appropriate as we could possibly make it. I really wish we could do this 6 months from now when we had a lot more information. They're really trying to set rates on an area that's very, very volatile right now.
Mm-hmm.
So I appreciate what you're doing, but we'd like to see what the team is doing and what that team consists of, and let's let the chips sort of fall where they may when the time comes.
Great. Thank you. We will be happy to bring information back to the committee and keep you all informed.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair, since you brought the subject up.
Yeah, go ahead. I was going to make a mess of anybody.
And particularly getting back to the mental health drug issue. And I can remember this last session or one of the previous sessions, we because of making the transformation and combining behavioral health with physical health, and recognizing that there was a need to have a smooth transition as we work with the CCOs and getting them on board, and in doing so, some negotiations was held, you know, at that time with the Oregon Health Authority and the governor's office to allow for that period of time so that we weren't immediately taking the mental health medications and suddenly putting them into a formulary without thinking about what its impacts or what would be on the individuals that were actually moving over. You know, this is an issue I probably have every session have had to come and talk about.
Mm-hmm.
And at every session, I've had to beat back individuals under the guise of saving dollars at the expense of actually doing more damage to the individual in the long haul. And I'm hoping we don't have to have those conversations again until we actually have made this smooth transition, because the $2 million or whatever it is can end up costing us three times that if we get it wrong. And, you know, I'm putting that out there. You know, everybody's heard this from me every session. And, you know, I don't want to, and as I said last session, I don't want to hold a head to the guns of the individuals in this population group for several reasons. One, they're probably like others, they have the least voice here in this building. And so I hope that there's a lot of conversation that's going on with NAMI and others. I know that Senator Bates shares the same sentiment that I do, that that's too much of a risk for us when we start talking about this particular group, and we did make that commitment the previous session that we would allow this transition, one, to get the CCOs on board to where they, too, have a better understanding of what they're dealing with, and because it's not just a matter of changing a prescription with this population, as you probably, and I know the doc knows, and this doc knows, that once you get a person actually balanced and medicated to where it's working, you don't do, oh my gosh, this one's cheaper over here, so I'm going to throw that in. So just wanted to put that on your radar screen in case it wasn't. I'm sure that probably NAMI has been in to talk to you, and it probably is.
Well, actually, I'll finish off this slide, but it's actually, we'll have that conversation on the next slide. But I'm going to go ahead and finish up this particular slide, slide 24, and then on slide 25, you'll see that we have, we'll have some more conversation about that particular topic. I did want to just talk a little bit about that we have some providers who remain on a cost-based reimbursement, so the what we call the safety net clinics or the federally qualified health centers. Medicaid is required, and we do pay a cost-based reimbursement. There's lots of different reasons that as to why that supports and helps maintain and ensure that we can have safety net clinics is by paying them the cost-based reimbursement. They do take Medicaid, primarily Medicaid, as well as uninsured. So it's they don't have, for example, a lot of commercial insurance to spread the costs across multiple payers. But I also wanted to highlight the fact that we are also working with various federally qualified health centers on what's called an alternative payment methodology that's recognized also nationally as being very innovative in the state that supports the goals of the triple aim of paying for a value and moving in that direction, et cetera. And it's been so successful that we've had a number of additional federally qualified health centers come to us and ask to begin to work on that infrastructure to put this alternative payment methodology into place. While it remains budget neutral in that sense that we continue need to pay this amount, it shows a lot of promise in being able to help change the way in which the delivery of care is provided and provide for outcomes of care, et cetera. So we're very excited about that opportunity and working with the safety net clinics and helping make sure that can happen. So with that, I'm going to turn to the next slide. And as promised, there's two pieces of legislation that are associated with the medical assistance program's budget. That's part of the governor's balanced budget. One of them has to do with the hospital assessment. That's House Bill 2395. That's actually already well along its way, and there's been a substantial change to that particular bill in that here it was noted that the original bill had September 30th as the sunset date of 2017 as the sunset date, and that has been extended the sunset date to September 30th of 2019. There was also some additional changes. So and thank you to the members of this committee who helped move that along. So and then the other House bill is one that Senator Winters was referencing, and that's House Bill 2421. It was incorporated into the governor's balanced budget. There have been many conversations with the various stakeholders involved, with the Oregon Health Authority, with NAMI, with coordinated care organizations, and the bill does two things. One, it does move the mental health drugs, instead of from a voluntary preferred drug list, it would move it to what's called the sort of a like it would be mental health drugs would be on the formulary like any other drug that we have that we cover today. It does have a grandfather clause associated with it, and it would also allow mental health drugs that are statutorily prohibited from being into paid for by coordinated care organizations. It would move them into allow them to be covered under the global budget of a coordinated care organization. The bill is has had, I believe, one hearing so far, but then there's lots, one work session, but there's been, now there are many conversations going on as to what are the best policy considerations on a going forward basis.
Can I ask a question? Has anyone decided to do a cost analysis of all this? You know, I'm tired of the argument every session, to be honest with you. And we talk about it in terms of policy, but I've seen no one come back on this argument with actually doing a cost-benefit analysis. I see, you know, and I've had this argument now and had this debate since probably 99. And so for me, and we, this body deals with cost, budget drivers. We also deal with the health and well-being of our citizens in this state. And so, you know, I guess I would feel better if someone came and said, if we did X, this is Y, rather than what we currently do. And I deliberately carved out this particular issue several years ago. And not only this one, looking at those particular pharmaceuticals, those things that, you know, we know that improves the lives of individuals. And, you know, Doc Bates just talked about HIV and also transplants. You know, there's some things that happen in our medical community. And I'm very cognizant of not all body metabolizes. And I'm not a doc, but not every body metabolizes everything the same way. So I hope everybody's listening to me out there, because if I have to have the same conversation that I did 2 years ago to put my exclamation point on why I do not think this is good policy, unless you can categorically tell me of the cost benefit and that you can also assure this senator that the CCOs are all equipped now to handle this new population that they're not accustomed to dealing with.
So, co-chairs, Senator Winters, thank you for that opportunity. I believe that we would be happy to have a more robust conversation about not just the cost benefit, but also the really the what we believe are the best treatment options that provides the best care for the individuals who are treated using these particular pharmaceuticals. I think the overall intent is to allow the best coordination, and that by having the care being sort of ordered on this side of the house, but being paid for over on this side of the house, on the fee-for-service side, leads to the possibilities and of actually bad treatment outcomes, because the mental health providers don't necessarily know what the what's happening on the physical health care side, and there can be severe side effects, et cetera. And so I think the overall intent is to produce a bill and move in the direction so that we can have the best coordinated care possible. Now, I believe that we can get there.
Let me offer a couple things real quickly, if I could. First off, on 2395, I want to thank publicly all the people who worked on this. People on this committee, Hospital Association, the CCOs, everybody involved. If this bill is going to be on the Senate floor today, it's already passed the House. I expect it will pass. Senator Winters will be carrying it. And I think that it is really going to be the key to balancing our budget this time. So it's really important this pass, and I appreciate everything everyone's done. As far as House Bill 2421 is concerned, I would offer that as you look at your rate setting, you assume that bill has not become law. I'll just say that right now. Just consider that as part of how you set your rates. The most complex organ we deal with is the human brain. If you want to have a group of people who have been grandfathered in on certain medications, but the next group can't get them, you're going to have problems there. 71% of the people in prison right now are there for drug and alcohol problems, and probably 30 to 40% are there for mental health problems. And that's just in the prison system. We're trying to set up entirely new ways of dealing with mentally ill people in the state. One of those is what I call a fast track to get people stabilized and into the right place, getting them into a mental health institution out in 23 hours. You pass a bill like this, you start limiting what medications can be given on a basis of trying something first and waiting a week or two and trying something else, waiting a week or two. That is not going to work. So with things changing so quickly right now, I would offer that you think of 24, 21, at this point, unless something else changes dramatically in that bill, as DOA. And just don't put that into the rates. Don't consider it that way. Build your rates without that being there. Senator Winters has my full support on this. There are CCOs that will be waiting for me out in the hallway when I step out of this room, and so I'm going through the window. But that's where we're at right now, and I think that's important we all recognize that and stop beating around the bush so we know where we're at and what we're considering, and we're clear on this. We have other issues we have to deal with, and I'd like to move on from that one.
So thank you, Co-Chair Bates. We always build our rates based on current law and not on future, not yet passed legislation.
Thank
so that was already taken into consideration. And thank you for stating your perspective.
Thank you.
and this actually provides a very nice segue into a conversation on our next slide, having to do with medical assistance programs and addictions and mental health. And that actually concludes my portion of the presentation, and we'll move on to a new and different presenter. So I'm going to step, invite up Director Ms. Saxton and next group. It's been a pleasure.
Well, it has been for us at least. Thank you. I do, Judy, appreciate you bringing this all forward. I'm glad we're talking about the real issues in this and not just skimming over the top. You did a great job. Thank you.
Good morning, Co-Chairs Nathanson and Bates. I'm Lynn Saxton, Director of the Oregon Health Authority. I just want to give kudos, recognition to Judy Moore Peterson, who is our state's Medicaid director and has encyclopedic knowledge of Medicaid. And she is leaving for her first trip to Europe here shortly and has not left the state for 17 years during the legislative session so that she can be of service to you all. And so we're going to try really hard to cover for her in her absence, but please know that she is the guru, and so you'll need to wait a couple weeks till she returns for any major Medicaid policy shifts. But we're very excited for her, and I appreciate her service to the state of Oregon in always factoring the legislative calendar into her personal life. So thank you to her.
Representative Booth.
Thank you. I just wanted to point out that not while I was a rep, but when I was a legislative assistant, I just set my computer clock up 9 hours, and I worked from over there, too. Just the same. Just kidding.
No.
Nobody knew I was gone. No. Have a great trip.
Thank you.
So, do not listen to her.
So
vacation's
when,
good.
When is she leaving? When is she getting back?
She's leaving Thursday afternoon. So
for how long?
2 weeks.
Where's she going?
Good for her.
Paris, Switzerland, London, you know, all the lovely. Yeah.
So committee members will be closing committee Thursday for 2 weeks until Judy gets, because it's a waste of time. Without Judy here, we can't really get by. So have a great time.
Have a great time.
Now we're both embarrassed. I like that. Lynn, lead us on.
Thank you. I wanted to just...
Identify yourself to committee. I'm sorry.
Pardon me?
I think I have to do that. Yeah. Oh, did you? Oh, sorry. I missed that.
I'm still Lynn. So, I wanted to introduce the MAP and AMH integrated piece here because it is part of the Oregon Health Authority restructure, which was part of what the prior governor and the current governor have asked me to lead at the Oregon Health Authority. And so last week we introduced the first phase of the restructure of the agency, and this Thursday we will be announcing the second and more detailed phase of the transition. 2 years ago, we were asked, and it was actually core to the blueprint laid for health system transformation, to integrate medical assistance programs and addictions and mental health in the new CCO structure that we have stood up. And now we're going to begin construction on that piece of the architecture. It is a critical piece of the architecture of health system transformation to be sure that clients and the people who are relying on Medicaid receive the most cost-effective, highest quality, and efficient care at all levels of the system. So we will begin, as I said on Thursday, we will be taking elements of mental health services and all of the medical assistance programs and aligning them with CCO operations and regulatory oversight under the direction of a chief health systems officer. And that is a new position in the agency. It will be posted in the next several weeks, and it will, that position will ensure that the Oregon Health Authority has crisp oversight for system transformation, and also that we can be a responsive partner to the 16 CCOs that are now delivering care. I'm excited about that transition. I think it gives us, as someone who's worked in the mental health area for the last 13 years, I think it gives us a real shot at integrating mental health services with physical and dental health services. It will be hard work, but I know the team is up to it, and we are fortunate to have the services of Linda Hammond, who has is retiring from state service, but will be helping us using lean processes and process engineering skills to ensure that alignment is both driven by clients' needs and the results of the system that we need to continue to achieve for Oregonians, particularly the cost savings gains that have already been made in Oregon for healthcare. That will include, that alignment will include service operating, service delivery systems, as well as regulatory systems, including rate setting, licensing, and compliance. The state hospital is the one exception that will not be aligned under the new chief health systems officer at present because of a number of considerations driven by our relationship with the Department of Justice, but also by the work they have underway to identify their current population's alignment with the CCOs. Currently, we think that's about half of the state hospital population, but we're going to maintain the state hospital under the behavioral health director, who will have responsibility for population health in the near future. So I just wanted to introduce that to you and say this is a work in progress. We're going to be doing everything we can as we move forward with this transition to have things in place by July 1, and then we'll begin the work with fiscal and budget offices to make sure we've got the framework supporting the transitions we're making in the agency. I think it's important to underscore that the scope of that change is significant, and it will be, I think we have both communications processes and work processes that will begin intensively next week to secure the success of this. As we go through that process between now and the end of June, certainly we welcome your comments, and we will be talking to all 16 CCOs this Thursday at 1:30 or 2 to introduce them to the restructure. And then beginning March 23rd, I will be meeting with all the stakeholders in the healthcare system, including advocacy groups and others, to meet with them on the restructure and get the benefit of their wisdom and experience. Again, the entire effort is directed to producing the results that we are all excited to be already seeing from health system transformation, but this next phase of implementation is really critical to securing the triple aim as we go forward over the next 5 years. Finally, to the point about pharmaceutical issues for the mental health population, to Senator Winter's question, part of what we talked about in the introduction of our budget is this kind of five-year look with our partners at how we continue to bend the cost curve, and that's part of the issues that will be factored into that work, which we will begin in the next 6 weeks. So with that, I'll stop and hand it off to our DMAP and AMH experts, but I'm happy to answer any questions you have.
Just one quick question, Mr. Chair, and I'm pleased with the direction that you're taking. And as part of your stakeholder group, I know you're working with the CCOs, but because anymore, and the universe that we're, population that we're serving, and both the Senator Bates and I serve on public safety, and the work that's being done in mental health and some of the wraparound services that they actually have become a part of as we talk about service delivery. Are you including them in some of this discussion? Because, you know, I just think that that's another partner that we need to have as we begin our service delivery.
Thank you, Senator Winters. They absolutely will be at the table in those meetings. Those meetings, there's between 175 and 200 stakeholders at least, and they will be at the table. I know we have done a lot of work with, I know of the efforts in Marion County to align behavioral health with the police department. I think there are a lot of exciting examples around the state of how to do it differently so people are not ending up in the state hospital, and we'll be joining with all those people in those conversations.
I'd also point out that agency head Colette Peters always starts her conversation with us by saying, I run the largest mental health institution in the state. Mm-hmm. It's called the correctional system.
Mm-hmm. Yes. Mm-hmm.
Okay, somewhere around 4,000 to 5,000 inmates are there because of mental health. So this obviously affects our entire society, and we are all aware of that. And I won't belabor that point, but I don't know if Oregon's an outlier as far as the number of people in prison and who are there because of mental health issues or not. I don't know that answer, but it's a substantial part of the population.
I think if you look at the doubling of the aid and assist population at the state hospital in the last 5 years, that's the best example I can give you of why we need to look at interventions that are successful going forward, and we will be doing that.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Steyer-Haywood.
And just to, I mean, not to belabor the point a little bit, we have to point out that there's a certain amount of a revolving door going on here, and it's not just the group that's under Ms. Peters' supervision, but the groups that spend so much time in our county jails. And so starting to think much more constructively and coherently about how we help people succeed, people with severe persistent mental illness, or even intermittent episodes that land them in hot water. How do we support them in ways that help them live productive, meaningful lives and keep them out of our jails and prisons? But most important, it's an assault to their human dignity. It's an affront to their dignity. And it's a denial of their worth to our society by not providing the wraparound services that help them stay healthy and live productive lives. And that troubles me more than anything else. Sorry, that was more of a poem than a question.
There's no question in there.
Okay. I apologize. I don't usually do that.
Okay. Please go. Go for it.
Good morning, Co-Chair Bates and Co-Chair Nathanson and members of the committee. For the record, my name is Rhonda Busick, and I'm the Interim Director for Medical Assistance Programs. And so what I was going to do, if it will work for the committee, is quickly just go through the focuses of our integration work as introduced by Ms. Saxton and what our focuses will be coming up between AMH and MAP. And so, again, just recognizing the CCOs have gone through integration work. We are working internally to reflect that work to provide better service integration so that we can respond to their needs as well as the needs of our members to increase program efficiency and effectiveness between our two programs, to coordinate, standardize, and align policies and procedures, processes that we have historically been siloed. We now need to have standardized and consistent so that no matter where a CCO, a member, a provider goes, it'll be a consistent, standardized answer. We want to improve accuracy, reliability, efficiencies, and responsiveness from us so we can meet our members' and CCOs' needs, as well as alignment of the OHA functions across both AMH and MAP for to achieve the results we want for Oregonians. Next. In addition to that, we're also doing some integration work with, in addition to MAP and AMH, with public health, and we're partnering closely to ensure that we're removing barriers on those programs that we share among us, and that we are promoting progress in achieving the triple aim for all of our shared members, regardless of where they're seeking their services, as well as coordinating our procedures regarding the billing and our rate structures, and to ensure that it's a consistent message given. So with that being said, I'm going to turn it over to my colleague, Ms. Pam Martin, to talk about the Legacy Health Regional Psychiatric Emergency Service Project.
Good morning. For the record, my name is Pam Martin, and I'm the Director of the Addictions and Mental Health Division for the Oregon Health Authority. And what I get to do is to talk about an exciting new program that's starting in Portland, and also as a demonstration of how we're working together at the Oregon Health Authority make good things happen in the community. So if you're in a car accident, the place you want to be taken is a trauma center with a fantastic staff, and they're, you know, that's where I want to be. If I'm having a psychiatric emergency, in general, an emergency department at 2 in the morning is probably not the best place for me. What we're finding is that because staff are not available to do psychiatric assessments on 24/7, or maybe difficult to find, you know, the right people at the right time, we have people who are being boarded in emergency departments, waiting for assessments, waiting for beds. So a number of people across the country have been concerned about this, and a number of people have looked towards Alameda, California, which is a large urban center, and Dr. Scott Zeller and his colleagues put together a psychiatric emergency service. So basically what it is an emergency department for psychiatric emergencies. So they have 24/7 staff, they have the right people at the right place at the right time, and they're getting phenomenal results. They're finding that they, within 23 hours, and very often before, they are getting people assessed, stabilized, and back in the community with a warm hand over to a community team. This is a program that is being supported by Legacy and their partners, Adventist, Kaiser, and OHSU. And the role of the Oregon Health Authority has been for public health, MAP, and AMH to come together as a team and to eliminate any barriers that they may be having around licensure, around rules, around rate setting. And it's an example of how we're working together with the health community.
Is anyone here aware of this program? I know you are.
Yeah, I'm aware of it too.
There's a lot of issues around this that need to be resolved yet, but it's obviously the right thing to do. So, Pam, I'm going to ask a couple of questions. Have we got CMS approval on the 23-hour codes for billing for this for Medicaid?
I know there are, Co-Chair Bates and members of the committee, there are discussions going on with CMS. I think we have had an open code, is that correct? There has been a code available for these services. The work that's being done now by MAP is to find a fee-for-service rate around that code.
And I'll just put this on the record as a question, okay? In building our rates for the CCOs, I assume if you have fee-for-service rates in there, you can then back build them into the CCO rates also. You follow me?
Yes. Okay. Thank you, Co-Chair Bates. We are working. I don't have a solution for you today, and we are incorporating it in our rates process. I will say that one of the advantages of bringing Optimus into our rate process in more directly in the last month is that they have national experience in other settings, so their problem-solving skills about how other states have worked with CMS to get from point A to point B have been invaluable to us, and we'll be using them in this process to help us find the proper solution.
And then, Pam, I know other communities are looking at this issue also of how we're dealing with our mentally ill people and stacking them in emergency rooms. They're looking now at the Portland program, and we'll be having discussions with them. I think many communities are going to look at the Portland program and say, how can we replicate that on a smaller scale in our communities? Not every community is going to have 24/7 psychiatrists available to them, and that's going to be the real key to it. But I would expect that with telemedicine, we can make that happen. And whether it be in Roseburg or Medford or Salem, Bend, any major city in our state can do this and have a replicationist program as long as we have that coordination out of the Portland area where you have enough mass to make it work. The other thing involved in this that's going to be discussed is adolescent and children beds. There simply isn't enough volume in the smaller cities to maintain those beds, nor the personnel you need to take care of them. And part of the discussion we had with a legacy was, would you consider the beds you're going to develop to be used by anyone in the state so we can transport those individuals up there very quickly, get them the help they need? They thought they could. I don't know what you've thought about that or what discussions you've had with them, but I'm looking and thinking about a statewide system that's really integrated across the state and really, for the first time, allows us to take care of mentally ill people in a way in which we don't put them in prison. We don't put them in state hospitals. We get them treated and back in the community as quickly as possible, the least restrictive setting we can have for them. So those discussions have been carried on deeper than what I'm aware of.
So, Co-Chair Bates and members of the committee, I agree with you that this program is scalable, that you don't have to be in a highly urban setting for it to work. In some areas, they've done it very much the way if you walk into some emergency departments or urgent care, you will have a kids section, a kids and families section. Some emergency departments have just a section that's for their psychiatric emergencies. So that I do agree it's scalable and we should look at that. I have not had discussions with the legacy folks around the adolescents. I think this is a new discussion. I will say, though, that Dr. Ajit Jetmalani and Amy Baker have been doing some work over the past year to look at the same issues around psychiatric boarding for children and adolescents and the number of psychiatric acute beds available in the state.
Co-Chairs Bates and Nathanson, if I might just add that Director Martin has worked on, and we will be happy to bring back to you later in the Ways and Means process, essentially what is a map of services continuum on the mental health side, and it will show where the gaps are both in the continuum of services but also the geographic gaps, which are really critical, and that's a great piece of work that she's initiated, and we look forward to bringing that back to you for further discussion, because that will help us allocate the right financial resources in the right direction.
Thank you. Any questions?
Well,
Representative Booth.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. You did cover most of mine, and And then just to follow up on the discussions regarding adolescent beds, is there a possibility that once this thing gets up and running, that transformation within communities can be refit so we can have at least one bed or something in the emergency department locally?
So part of my commitment to you at our opening session was to under-promise and over-deliver, and so I'm not going to make a commitment there until I see this kind of layout of the continuums, the services, and the geographic distribution. So okay. Hold that good thought, and we'll be back to you with a direct answer.
Thank you. Thanks.
Please continue.
Thank you. So I'm going to call up the folks from the AMH team now. Thank you. So we're really excited to be here this morning to talk to you about the programs that are going on across the state and some of our vision for the future. So for the record, you want to introduce yourselves?
Hi, I'm Amy Baker, and I'm the Child and Family Manager with the Addictions and Mental Health Division with the Oregon Health Authority.
Good morning. Happy birthday, Senator Bates. My name is Karen Wheeler, and I'm the Behavioral Health Administrator for the Addictions and Mental Health Division.
Welcome to both of you.
So I'm going to talk about the system as it now exists, and I just want to say that this is a system that can be the foundation for an even better system going forward. Mental health and substance abuse disorders are a major public health concern all across the country. And Senator Bates, to answer your question before about, or Senator Winters, about whether Oregon has more people in prison with mental illness than other states, I would say no. This is a problem that we're finding everywhere. So 1 in 20 people have serious mental illness. Over 4,000 Oregonians have died from drug overdose since 2000. And another statistic that's not on this slide is that 81,000 people in Oregon meet the criteria for having a gambling disorder, which is really disruptive to families and work and everything else. And the other thing is that Oregonians with severe mental disorders die earlier than the general population. Life expectancy for women in the United States is now over 81 years of age, and for men, it's over 76. That's about an average of like 79, 80 years old. People who receive mental health treatment only die an average age of 71, so that's 8 years earlier than the general population. Oregonians who are treated only for substance abuse die on average age 50. And this was a study that was done by the Oregon Health Authority several years ago. And Oregonians who were treated for both substance abuse and mental health died at an average age of 45. So the integration of behavioral health services and physical health services is absolutely essential for people to achieve health. Some of this disparity can be explained by suicides, maybe 20 to 30%, but the majority there is people are dying from exactly the same things the general population die of: metabolic disorder, heart disease, diabetes, all of those things. But it's because these conditions go untreated, and they're exacerbated by lifestyle, and in part by some of the medications, the psychiatric medications. So that's a real concern. Thank you. Kids are also of great concern to us. The top five diagnoses for Oregon kids getting Medicaid services are ADHD, adjustment disorders, disorders of infancy and childhood, depression and mood disorders, and anxiety disorders. That takes up about 75% of the diagnoses. The other problem, of course, is that
It's telling me that when kids in the Medicaid program are seen in a physician's office, 75% of the time they're being seen for those disorders. I'm not sure I understand.
Senator Bates, members of the committee, among kids who are being seen for anything, these are the top five things they're being seen for. For mental health. No, I think ear infections are probably way higher than this.
I'm hoping child checks are way higher.
Yeah. Yeah. A little bit different than my practice.
Immunizations.
Like, oh, my God. For mental health. That's a good point.
Yeah, yes.
I didn't hear you say that. Probably you did.
Sorry.
I just missed it.
Okay. We're also very concerned about suicide. Two people die every day on average from suicide in Oregon. And so, Oregon historically ranks among the top 10 states for the incidence of suicide.
Excuse me, Mr. Chair.
Oh, go, Senator.
Can you do something for me? Because you mentioned you didn't know whether or not DOC's rates were higher than the state average. Could you actually, because going back, we know that over 70% of DOC's residents have alcohol and drug issues. That we know. And then you combine some of the mental health. Would you check with Colette and see how her stats mirror with yours? More and more, I know this senator and I are trying to actually bring together these two particular departments because we see some of the same issues there that we see in the greater population. And just from the of talking about maximizing resources and some of the other issues that are involved. So it would be helpful if you loop back with Director Peters and kind of tell us what universe is as it compares with the rest of it.
Senator Winters, we will bring that information back to the committee. It's accessible through the Department of Justice and there are other sources that we can look at.
And a follow-up question we ran into yesterday was, as people leave the correction system, knowing that 70% of them have drug and alcohol problems, what's the length of time before they get into a treatment program when they leave the prison system? Now, they get signed up for OHP pretty quickly, but it looks like it's weeks or months before they get treated. And that gap is really, really important for them going back into drug and alcohol problems and then ending back in prison again. And that's a key issue for us to look at. And Colette Peters wasn't quite certain how effective that handoff is in different parts of the state. So that's something to focus on. They should walk out of there and the next day be in a program. These people are high risk, super high risk, and I'm afraid they fall back into meth and opiates and everything else, and they go into crime to pay for that, and the system keeps going.
Senator Bates, we will come back to you with the information about that as well.
Thank you.
Thank you. But if I have a most important slide, I would say that it is this one. This is probably the most important slide we're going to show to you today because we really want to say that treatment works and people do recover. This is a slide from the National Council for Behavioral Health, and the success rates for the management of bipolar disorder, manic depression and panic disorder, and schizophrenia are comparable to those for people with physical health care problems. When we talk about recovery, what we're talking about is that the condition doesn't go away. Now, some of these conditions are genetic, some of them are chronic, but that they're under management and people have a full and rich life in their community. And Karen Wheeler pointed out to me as well that the rates for people recovering from addictions are comparable. And so often this slide, which represents hope, gets lost. So thank you. Our mission is to make sure that people achieve good health physically, mentally, and socially. And we're organized in order to have that happen. This is the Addictions and Mental Health organizational structure. We've made several important changes over the last year after taking quite a bit of time to look at what our routine work was throughout our part of the agency. So one of the most important things is we all realize the importance of combining addictions treatment and mental health treatment, and that wasn't structured that way in our own area. So what we did was we combined all clinical programs under Karen Wheeler, and so you can see that there. We broke Mike Morris away from some of these duties in order to have a policy function and to manage our some of our large projects, our work with the United States Department of Justice and our Behavioral Health Strategic Plan and other things that on that scale. And since we have now data coming in and reports that need to be managed, we moved Justin Hopkins to an area that not only includes quality assurance around licensing and certification, but also quality improvement. So as our data systems are better, we have people who will review, inform the OHA Quality Council, inform our providers, inform consumers, inform the legislature about progress. So that's the changes that we made. I wanted to point out that we have 13 people who spend most of the time in the field doing, these are quality assurance specialists who provide regulatory oversight and technical assistance for about 1,200 individuals and provider organizations. So that's the kind of work that's currently done in the quality management area. Thank you. Next one. So this is a very simple slide about how funding turns into services. Starting on the left with the Medicaid funding, all funding that could be matched by Medicaid was moved out of the AMH budget when the CCOs started, and now that is all matchable funds are in the CCO budget. So those funds, of course, go for services with the Oregon Health Plan through the coordinated care organizations to providers and then to services. On the other side, the state and federal funds, the addictions and mental health receive three block grants from the federal government in the areas of prevention, mental health treatment, and addictions treatment. And we also have one a small grant that's called a PATH grant that's to help alleviate homelessness. It's the Projects for Assistance from Homelessness grant, and we were awarded a prevention grant, a five-year prevention grant in 2009, and Karen will talk about that later. So the funding streams we have are federal monies, state general fund, and some competitive grants that we get awarded. So that's where that money comes from.
Pam? Yeah.
And
beer and wine tax.
Beer and wine tax as well.
I'm sorry.
I'm being reminded. Thank you.
I'm always a little confused on the state and other federal funds, addictions and mental health grants. With the advent of the Affordable Care Act, the fact that Oregon accepted that act, and with the large number of people we have now insured and a very small, not insured now, I would guess most of the insured people that have mental health and drug and alcohol problems are probably in the Medicaid programs. Why do we keep the block grants out of the CCOs? Why have we not brought that over?
Well, Senator Bates, I think it's a really excellent question, and there are a lot of different answers. I don't think that there's going to be a one-size-fits-all answer. I think what we hope to show you is how some of the funding that we have from the block grants is for any Oregonian. Any Oregonian who needs a service. And then others of them may have very good potential to be in the Medicaid system. It's gonna depend on the not just the funding source, but what the purpose of the funding is, and if it's population based or if it's service based.
Well, we'll be listening for more of that. I know it seems to me a lot of the community programs are migrating over into the CCOs. I'm not sure that's universal. But it still remains a hodgepodge at times, and very difficult to track, difficult to track the way, difficult to track the outcomes. I'd like to hear more of this as we go along.
Mr. Chair, thank you.
Senator Steiner-Haywood.
One of the biggest challenges, it seems to me, Ms. Martin, is that mental health has traditionally, provision of overarching mental health services has traditionally been the provision of the purview of the counties, as opposed to directly under AMH or OHA through MAP. And could you talk, is this an appropriate time to have you talk a little bit about the conversations that you're having with the counties and what they see as their future and how they see this process going forward with provision of mental health services? Or if it's a better time to talk over the next couple of days, that's fine, and you can put me off.
Co-chairs and Senator Steiner-Bates. No, I think it's a very... I'm sorry. Steiner-Hayward. I'm sorry.
I won't tell Michael if you don't tell Lori.
It's a question we're all asking. We want to hear. And if you want to do it tomorrow, it's fine, but it's going to be there.
I think it's a very complicated question, and it's the question, you're correct, that everyone is asking. What I think might be interesting is if we talk about the programs we do have and how we're managing them and some of the outcomes-driven information we're gathering, I think it will be a lot clearer about a direction that we might want to take. If that seems like a good plan, we struggle to explain how these things come together as well.
That in and of itself is concerning to all of us, as I'm sure it is to you.
If you go to the next one, I will tell you about my current way of thinking about this, because I've given this a great deal of thought. The federal government has chosen to send us money through CMS Medicaid and to send us money through SAMHSA. So this has always been problematic, and states have had to figure out how to braid this money together. So here's how I'm trying to think of it now. If the health plan is a brick, and you have a pile of bricks, they're very solid, they're well made, we know exactly what they provide. The Oregon Health Plan has like 127 codes around mental health, and including diagnostic evaluation, psych testing, group psychotherapy, all the things, music therapy, movement therapy, rehab, some acute care, all the things you might think of, and some of the things each of us has in our own health plan as well. So that's the brick. The mortar around this health home are a number of things that the addiction and mental health provides. Prevention, early intervention, and we're going to talk about each of these areas, the crisis services, jail diversion, housing. But we're not the only mortar. The TANF program is mortar. SNAP is mortar. The local food bank is mortar. The neighbor is a mortar. The natural supports. So that's how we're trying to think of it. If Medicaid is the brick, we're the mortar that helps people build that health home around them. So we've given an example. And this is Jessie, our single mom, our fictional single mom of two. But I chose her because the women I worked with in jails each had 2.75 kids. So this is really, really what happens. So Jessie's a single mom with a minimum wage job. She has a behavioral health diagnosis. She has PTSD, and she's got episodic alcohol, and when she can get a hold of pills, she does. She lives and couch surfs with relatives and friends. Her brick, her Medicaid, is going to be medication, Family therapy, mammography, dental, well child visits, all of those things. But the mortar is going to be the rental assistance that we can provide her to get her in safe, affordable, sober housing, mobile crisis, so that when something happens at her home, she has somebody who comes, and maybe a CIT-trained officer who will de-escalate the situation so she's not back in jail. She may need a period of time where she has residential treatment. AMH will pay the room and board for that. We provide the background and training so that her child's therapist is well trained in parent-child interaction therapy and other evidence-based treatments. And we may be able to provide even a voucher program through an Access to Recovery grant. So she also may be involved with drug court. And she already has, we know that she has friends and relatives who help her out some. And I don't even think that's the end of it. I mean, I think we could talk about other child welfare services. The folks we deal with have multiple needs. We haven't talked about the educational system, if any of her kids are on an IEP. We don't know if she has a probation officer. So these are complicated people. Our goal is that Jessie doesn't feel that the funding source the funding source should be completely seamless for her. These services should just wrap around her and her children. So she's our way of trying to understand how these services come together.
Senator Boone.
Thank you. Pam?
Yes.
Is there any part of all that, I mean, I get all that, and that's great. Is there any part of that that engages Jessie in the future and how she's going to transform out of the services and, you know, to be on her own and helping her children grow up with maybe not a repetition of all this?
Co-chairs, Representative Boone, absolutely. And we have a supported employment program. This is actually a Medicaid-sponsored. It is a Medicaid-paid benefit, but we provide, AMH has engaged a center of excellence to monitor those programs, and we've been working to bring that service statewide. I really have to say that for somebody like Jessie, that her health home really has to start with a place for her to live with her kids and a job. And we do have programs around that. That's why we're the mortar around her, the rest of her plan.
Representative Stark.
Thank you, Senator Bates. Just a quick touch on this. From my experience, I've seen that their wraparound services are quite impressive. My wife is a professional social worker, and so she has her own private practice. She's a subcontractor for, you know, some of the CCOs in our area. And I mean, literally just 2 weeks ago, she was telling me about an individual that didn't want to go work, would have fit this bill pretty well, but they got her plugged into a job, and she called her recently just telling her how much her own self-worth and the value that she was experiencing, and how that job, getting her placed into a job, was making a world of difference in everything else in her life. And so I've seen how well they are attempting to wrap these individuals in services. And at least according to my wife, hearsay here, but she's quite impressed with this.
Let me ask you a question, if I mm-hmm. could. Your wife works as a subcontractor for a CCO.
For Options of Southern Oregon, which is contracted by the CCOs.
Okay, Options is a county mental health operation.
Yes.
And yet some of these services we would think of coming out of DHS.
Right.
And somehow, and I think it's a better way to handle it, is the way Options and whichever CCO that Options are working with, others too, they probably work with both. So does money flow from DHS over to AMH on these kind of wraparound services, or is it completely separated from each other?
Amy wants to take this question.
The way that it works currently within the wraparound system of care is that essentially for specific individuals, you have a team of folks that wrap around them, and typically that would include DHS. And if the team is working in the way that it's supposed to, people say, hey, I can pick up this. The family needs this. Great. I got that covered. This is a mental health service. Yep, we're on it. And so it happens within a child and family team context. Now, that being said, the original wraparound that started in 2009 was actually child welfare ponying up the general fund to help us draw down the federal match to start the original four pilots of wraparound. So I would say both are true. But mostly right now, it happens on a child and family team basis. My goal before I'm dead is that at some point it will happen more on a higher structural level.
Can I follow? This is a little unusual.
Sure.
You have some expertise here that can help us. So the woman was placed at a job, or if a job was found, did they go to the job council for that? Well, how did that occur? As your wife working essentially as a social worker and trying to get wraparound services, I could see getting housing and mental health and kids' health and all that stuff, but they took the next step and got her a job. How did Options or your wife manage that?
So, Senator Bates, you're asking questions beyond my pay grade. Okay. My expertise stops at these 140 codes because I do all my wife's billings. So that, everything else, I just hear the stories of her coming back and talking about being able to get clients involved in wraparound services. She is a professional counselor, so she focuses on the counseling. But I know that the Options as a whole, she's able to connect with the proper people on her team, her resource team, and get people plugged in. But how that is actually carried out, I don't know.
Thank you. Thanks. Any suggestion of how that magic happened?
Well, presumably, I mean, there's for all the different services that happen in the community, there's a way that those get funded. The beauty of wraparound is that it coordinates all those people. The money's there. They're going to do the service. What you want is to have them do it in a coordinated effort.
So, thank you.
Complex. Keep going.
The next slide, we're going to talk about prevention. And one thing we wanted to emphasize today was how much attention there is being paid in the behavioral health world to evidence-based promising practices. In the late 1990s, there in the prevention area, there was a real push towards model programs and practices. And the Center for Substance Abuse Treatment, which is within the Substance Abuse and Mental Health Services Administration, determined a huge need to embed best practices, but embed them in the context of communities. And to meet that need, they developed a roadmap to help communities do just that. And that was the Strategic Prevention Framework State Incentive Grant Program that I mentioned. Oregon was awarded in 2009. And so Karen is going to discuss some of these programs.
Thank you. Good morning again. My name is Karen Wheeler, for the record. And I'm going to talk about prevention. First of all, I do have just one comment about the funding. I'd just like to say that the CCOs do subcapitate with the same community mental health programs that manage the funding that we send to the counties. So I think it's really an important dialogue to track the money and kind of see where it goes. So the people that manage the behavioral health benefit at the county level are really kind of braiding the funding together to make it work in a way that Pam was describing by giving the example of the individual who had services wrapped around her and getting clinical help. So I don't want to belabor that, but I thought it was important to mention. The Addictions and Mental Health Division is designated as Oregon's single state agency for substance abuse prevention, and we're also the only state entity that focuses on problem gambling prevention in Oregon. Since this is a budget presentation, $10.7 million of the $12.3 million allocated to prevention programming comes from the Federal Substance Abuse Prevention and Treatment Block Grant. $433,000 is for general fund for prevention. And there's also beer and wine taxes and some projected marijuana tax dollars that are in the prevention budget for the next biennium. Sorry, I have to wear these, I guess. The legislative mental health investments from 2013 and 14, and I would just like to applaud everyone's leadership in making that happen. It's a significant investment. It's definitely producing results, and you'll hear about those in the next few days. But those investments in prevention, for the first time, invested in mental health promotion and prevention. And it built upon the infrastructure that existed in the substance abuse prevention arena. So this funding added to these programs so that it built mental health promotion and prevention across 20 communities. Prevention capacity exists throughout every tribe and county in the state. We provide base funding to tribes as well as counties. And as Pam was referencing, in terms of the risk behaviors such as smoking, binge drinking, drug use, problem gambling, the science of prevention really provides a framework for us that's similar across all kinds of risk behaviors. And Pam mentioned the strategic prevention framework. So this framework provides us with a roadmap for assessing population-level health, looking at survey data from a variety of sources, consequence and consumption data, and crime data that's related to behavioral health and crime. It helps us look at capacity building, so what does a community really have in place that can help prevention efforts come to fruition? Are there existing coalitions? Are there programs that are already providing parenting prevention, for instance? Is there school-based prevention? The strategic prevention framework involves engaging key leaders in prevention so that the efforts are sustainable and supported over time. It also is about implementing evidence-based strategies, picking strategies that work and matching those to the population-level data that was analyzed before and the capacity that exists in the community. So that matching needs to happen so that these efforts can be sustainable. And then it involves measuring the results and evaluating to make sure that the indicators are moving down, if that's how we want them to move down, or up, if we want them to move up. So it's about changing attitudes and behaviors to have a healthier population. And AMH employs 8 people who focus on substance abuse, problem gambling prevention, and mental health promotion and prevention. These folks organize a variety of meetings throughout the state. We provide technical assistance. We provide workforce development. And one of our underage drinking prevention coordinators actually manages a campaign called the More Campaign. And on the next slide, you'll see an infographic. This is a positive community norms campaign designed to reduce underage drinking in Oregon by engaging parents, educators, the community, and getting the right messages about what is really, in fact, happening in Oregon. In fact, most kids are not drinking in Oregon. Most kids are not binge drinking in Oregon. Most kids are not using drugs in Oregon. So it's really normalizing that positive behavior.
Indulge me a little more time. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you for showing us this slide this as part of your PR strategies. It's so much more useful, put it that way, than some of the ones that have been in the past, and you can understand it and appreciate that. And Amy, I appreciate what you said. I've made the comment before myself, and please don't die anytime soon. But thank you. I appreciate this use of, I don't know how much something like this costs for this campaign, but even the other day I mentioned the tobacco prevention, you know, and how much was spent on that. Totally unbelievable stuff that was, and we hear the outcome of that. We hear people say, "You people, we're the you people. You spend our tax dollars on these things, these billboards we don't even understand," and that's what sticks in people's mind. So this is really good.
So I'm going to ask you to come back tomorrow and start on prevention and mental health promotion preventive programs, and we'll start that as fresh conversation tomorrow morning. Okay. Does that work for you?
Works for me.
Okay, well, we'll close this down. I hope everybody goes out tonight and has a little green beer or whatever you want. And enjoy yourselves. Have a great St. Patrick's. And we'll see you back here tomorrow morning at 8:30. And we are adjourned. Thank you.
Thank you.
Does it have to be?
Thank you.
Thank you.
Does it have to be?
We are adjourned. Thank